Before we get into today's episode on Marcus Garvey and the Pan-African Movement, I must provide a disclaimer, and that is just to say that this is an update to the first episode that we had in our entire podcast series, which was obviously dedicated to Marcus Garvey. So I do apologize for any audio or technical difficulties that you may have heard had you been privy to listen to that one before we were able to remove it. This here will actually be the same information. It will just be presented today much clearer light. So I do apologize. However, with that being said, let's get into the episode on Marcus Garvey and the Pan-African Movement. Welcome to the Black History Podcast. I'm your host, Nishad Carrington. Today we have a piece of our history that actually kind of begins it all. And I don't mean in a historical sense, but I'm really meaning kind of a theological and philosophical sense in the matter that this individual was really the first nationwide proponent of Black nationalism and Black solidarity. Okay, so Marcus Messiah Garvey Jr. was born on August 17, 1887 in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica, to Marcus Garvey Sr. and Sarah Jane Richards. Being the youngest of 11 children, who was born to a mason and a domestic worker, Marcus was able to really get life lessons of self-sufficiency very early in his life. And one particularly poignant instance, when he was actually still a young child, Marcus Sr. was working in a cemetery when Junior was with him. Now, once Sr. had dug a grave, Sr. actually had Junior get into the grave, but then pulled the ladder out of the grave and left young Marcus to fend for himself. Now, that sounds very, very harsh and really kind of the type of situation today that'll probably get somebody calling the Department of Children and Family Services on you and just a headache and a hassle that you wouldn't want to deal with. But this lesson was very instrumental in Marcus Garvey's life, and it really kind of always stuck with him as really a shining example that, you know, in life, you really only have yourself to depend on. Now, he was able to expand this, you know, this ideal and concept of, you know, self-sufficiency much further to include, you know, your entire race and that premise and kind of responsibility of cultural responsibility. But this really would serve him well into adulthood. This life lesson of self-sufficiency would. Now, according to various sources, Marcus Garvey Sr. was actually a very learned and self-educated man, although, you know, he was employed doing manual labor. He apparently, maintained a very large collection of books in their home. And this love of reading that Sr. had really kind of kindled within Marcus Jr. a love of reading and a quest for advanced knowledge. Okay, so we're going to shift gears just a little bit and kind of discuss a timeline of his life so that you kind of understand where this voice of activism really came from within him. Now, the earliest known instances of political activism for Marcus Garvey came in 1907, and he was a participant in a painter strike in his homeland of Jamaica. Now, according to the record, the strike was unsuccessful, but this foray of his into community and labor activism really built that fire within him for his later life of political activism. Okay, so 3 years later, in 1910, Marcus Garvey actually left Jamaica and began traveling throughout Central America, with his first stop being in Costa Rica. Now, while he was there, he actually lived with a relative from his mother's side of the family, and he took up work for several months as the head man at a banana plantation. But while he was there, he also worked for a newspaper called La Nacional. And later in 1910, Garvey would move to Colon, Panama. Now, there isn't much from any verifiable source as to what he did or the specifics as to his time in Panama, but we do know that he actually worked for a different newspaper, but really not much detail other than that. So in 1912, Garvey returns to Jamaica, where he remained for 2 years until 1914, when he actually left Jamaica for London. Now, when he was in London, Marcus Garvey attended Birkbeck College and took classes in both law and philosophy. Now, I would be inclined to believe that, you know, Garvey coming from Jamaica and then going to Central America, you know, obviously both of those being areas that are predominantly non-white, but were colonized by Europeans, and then going to a majority white city like London to study law and philosophy really, really had a drastic impact on his future, his belief, his disposition, his outlook, and really a very vital, pivotal point in shaping his activism. Okay, so in 1914, with immense help from his very first wife, Amy Ashwood Garvey, He would actually get married to her 5 years later in December of 1919. Marcus Garvey organized the Universal Negro Improvement Association, which was also known as the UNIA. So you'll hear us refer to this later in this episode as the UNIA. In other episodes in the podcast series, you will also hear us refer to the Universal Negro Improvement Association as the UNIA. So just keep that in mind, UNIA. Now, the UNIA was organized as a social, friendly, humanitarian, charitable, educational, institutional, constructive, and expansive society, and was founded by people desiring to do the utmost work for the general uplift of the people of African ancestry of the world. And the members of the UNIA pledged themselves to do all in their power to conserve the rights of their noble race and to respect the rights of all mankind, believing always in the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God, with the UNIA's motto being one God, one aim, one destiny. The inspiration for the creation of the UNIA actually came while Garvey was traveling throughout Central America, when he really became convinced that uniting blacks was the only way to improve their condition. Okay? So in 1916, Garvey began traveling throughout the United States, actually, to promote the messages of the UNIA. And in 1917, the New York division of the UNIA was created, with only 13 original members. However, remarkably, after only 3 months, the influence and the spread of the vision assisted the organization to have a dues-paying membership of roughly 3,500 members. On July 2nd, 1917, the East St. Louis riots broke out. And on July 8th, Garvey gave an address titled The Conspiracy of the East St. Louis Riots at Lafayette Hall in Harlem. During the speech, he declared that the riot was, quote, one of the bloodiest outrages against mankind. Now, this statement further condemned the hypocritical American claims to represent democracy when black people were being victimized. And in Garvey's own words, black people were being victimized for no other reason than they are black people seeking an industrial change in a country that they have labored for 300 years to make great. It was really after this polarizing and incendiary speech that Garvey was then able to not only step into the sole leadership role of the UNIA, but he was also able to establish himself as the leading voice of the African community and really the complete diaspora. Not only in the United States, as many of his contemporaries were limiting themselves to, but he was also able to create a strong presence in Europe, the West Indies, and Central America as well. In August of 1918, Marcus Garvey founded the Negro World. Now, the Negro World was established as a weekly newspaper to express the ideas and platforms of the organization. And each week, the front page editorial was dedicated to further development of the organization's position on different issues related to the African diaspora. Now, through self-publication, eventually the circulation of the Negro World grew to be 500,000. And the paper was actually printed in several different languages. There was a page that was dedicated specifically to the black woman reader as well. Marcus Garvey did not discount the contributions of black women. And I have to think a huge part of that was actually due to his own wife, Amy Ashwood Garvey. Now, the publication would actually continue until 1933. But a little bit more on Amy Ashwood. She would actually serve a vital role to the growth and development of not only the UNIA, being a founder, but she was also a constant figure in the Negro World and its editorial efforts. And though history credits Marcus Garvey with the founding of the Negro World, it was actually Amy Ashwood who was the driving force and the actual founder of the paper. Okay? So by June of 1919, the membership in the UNIA had eclipsed 2 million dues-paying members. And on June 27th of the same year, the UNIA established what Garvey is probably the best and most known for, the Black Star Line of Delaware. This was the first modern black or African-owned passenger or cargo shipping fleet in the known world. Now, through various stock offerings and a very hefty initial capitalization, the 3 ships that were owned by the Black Star Line were owned and operated completely by black people and made travel and trade possible between the United States, the Caribbean, Central America, and various stops on the African continent. Now, we're going to get more to the Black Star Line in just a minute. So just hang on to that notion of the Black Star Line. Again, 3 ships that were owned by them, owned completely by black people, and it really opened up trade routes between the U.S., Caribbean, Central America, and Africa. Now, in the spring of 1921, Garvey made strong efforts to tour through the West Indies and Central America, selling additional Black Star Line stock. Although Garvey was successful in raising considerable amounts of money, the United States State Department sought to make it very, very difficult for him to re-enter the United States, having previously declared Garvey to be a dangerous radical, and through ordering the countries to which he was visiting to refuse to grant him a visa. These orders were later rescinded. However, Marcus Garvey, being the intelligent and intuitive man that he was, began to feel that increasing pressure and hostility on himself and the UNIA from the U.S. government. And considering his affairs, he could very easily be deported by hostile government officials because at the time, obviously, he was not a U.S. citizen. Now, after World War I, Marcus Garvey continued his dream of an African homeland. And once the defeated Germans were stripped of their African colonies and possessions, in 1922, Marcus Garvey sent a delegation to the League of Nations. Now, any of you history buffs, you may remember that the League of Nations was actually the predecessor to the United Nations. Now, what Garvey sent that delegation to do was to formally request that the former German colonies actually be turned over to the African diaspora. Now, I want you to get a concept and understanding of kind of this land mass that he's talking about here, right? So former German colonies prior to World War I consisted of present day, in whole or in parts, obviously borders have been redrawn to a certain degree. Now this was present day or in parts, Zanzibar, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, Kenya, Mozambique, Namibia, Botswana, Cameroon, Nigeria, Ghana, Togo, and the Congo. We're talking a very large piece of the African continent right here. The League of Nations very, very briefly considered this petition. However, the matter was actually later dropped in favor of expanding the empires of the British and the French in these parts of Africa. And what ultimately amounted was delegating these former German colonies to already existing colonial and imperial powers operating on the continent already. This kind of tells you the way the world works. Rather than give the African diaspora its due comeuppance, which I shouldn't say give, I should say restore, they prefer to give these colonies back and recognize on an international stage to operating imperial and colonial powers. Now, later in 1922, Garvey was actually indicted and convicted of federal mail fraud charges relating to the stock sale of the Black Star Line. He eventually served 3 years of a 5-year sentence in federal prison and was ultimately deported back to Jamaica. Now, I fully understand that it may seem like we just made a huge leap from Garvey's petition to the League of Nations and his activism work to a federal conviction. But really, in the timeline of his life, that's exactly kind of what happened as well. But don't worry, that's actually what we're going to tackle next. And the case against Garvey is not only a turning point in his life, but also for the UNIA, and ultimately a major turning point in turn-of-the-century Black nationalism. Now, we're going to get to that. Let's just hit one of our sponsors really quick and keep the bills paid, and we'll be right back in just a second. Make Music Count. The mission of Make Music Count is to increase elementary and secondary students' mathematical skill development through piano playing and reducing their math anxiety. By incorporating music into each lesson, students become engaged through music while simultaneously learning mathematical concepts. Each lesson is based on learning musical notes in a song. Each note is derived through solving a mathematical equation that is able to vary from addition and subtraction all the way up to algebraic equations. Therefore, solving math equations leads directly to playing the piano and a much more positive attitude towards math. If you get a chance, check out our friends at MakeMusicCount.com and let them know that the Black History Podcast sent you. Now back to Marcus Garvey. While justified in its legal legitimacy, the conviction for mail fraud against Garvey was based really on a technicality at best, which, you know, as we see from television and I'll tell you from some real court cases, usually that's in the reverse where the defendant is, you know, let off on a technicality and not convicted for the same. Now, in a speech in New York in May of 1923, Marcus Garvey actually insisted that the case against him involved not Marcus Garvey, but the existence of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. The ideals of the Universal Negro Improvement Association were on trial, according to Garvey. Now, Garvey's posturing through the course of history, and really while looking back on the official records, it is highly possible position that carries a little bit of weight. For a time before the charges of mail fraud were instituted, government officials were seeking their best to bring charges against Garvey, namely for tax evasion. However, Garvey and the UNIA played directly into the hands of the government and its federal prosecutorial powers by the selling of Black Star Line stock through the U.S. mail. All right, so I'm gonna have to throw on a little bit of a legal lawyer hat here for a second, just kind of explain this. So just bear with me, you know, keep up. I'm gonna break this down as easy as I possibly can. All right, so as mentioned before, the Black Star Line was accomplished through an initial maximum capitalization of $500,000. It's a lot of money in the early 20s. With stock certificates actually being sold at UNIA conventions to participants at increments of $5 a piece. This is how the Black Star Line was wholly owned and operated by not only Black people, but also members of the UNIA. So 6 months after incorporation, the board of directors, which actually consisted of Garvey, a man named Edgar Gray, Mr. Richard E. Warner, Mr. George Tobias, Mr. Jeremiah Certain, Miss Henrietta Vinton Davis, and Miss Janie Jenkins voted to increase the market capitalization to $10 million, an even heftier sum in the early 20s. Now, as the Negro world was the choice for mass dissemination of information related to the UNIA, in addition to the use of brochures, the UNIA decided to purchase an additional ship to add to its growing fleet, with the ship actually being named the SS Phyllis Wheatley. The best way for the UNIA to raise funds for the Wheatley was to conduct business as usual, meaning soliciting and raising the funds through a stock issuance to its members. The easiest way to reach them was through the Negro World. Upon placing the advertisement in the official UNIA brochures and the paper, the advertisements included photographs of the vessel that they were going to be purchasing, as well as grand promises of the ship's impending launch and travel to Africa. However, at the time, the Black Star Line had not yet completed negotiations for the purchase of the ship when the advertisements were run. And as expected, they were having a great amount of difficulty in guaranteeing payment for the ship. Now, the technicality that the UNIA fell into was really much more of a catch-22, because the sale of stock was needed to raise the funds necessary to complete the transaction that would fully transfer the ownership and operation of the ship to the Black Star Line. But at the same time, the UNIA did not officially own the ship in question for which it was issuing the stock. All right, did you catch that? So I'm gonna say it one more time. The technicality they fell into was really more of a catch-22, okay? So they needed to sell stock in order to raise the funds necessary to finish buying the ship and then transferring ownership to themselves. But they did not own the ship that they were selling the stock for at the time they were selling it, okay? So the United States charged four different individuals: Marcus Garvey, Miss Ellie Garcia, Mr. George Tobias, and Mr. Orlando Thompson for illegally sending false and misleading Black Star Line advertisements through the mail. Thus the charge for mail fraud. Garvey's point earlier that we mentioned regarding the officials not attacking him directly, but instead attacking the ideals and the base for which the UNIA stood upon were pretty clear. All right. So for many, the UNIA represented a hope of repatriation, or the quote, back to Africa promise. The UNIA also represented leadership and really reversing the long maintained patterns of racial abuse and subservience up out of slavery and community held labor. The leadership of the UNIA hoped to create a Black owned shipping industry where, as Garvey put it in his own words, Black men would be at the helm instead of in the hold of the ship, as well as working a passenger line that would treat its Black passengers with dignity, and an international shipping system where mineral resources, agricultural, and industrial products would be exchanged between Black producers and consumers the world over. thereby circumventing the white economy in totality. Now, the whole of the government's case against Garvey actually rested upon the sale of stock to one individual, a man named Mr. Benny Dancy, out of the thousands of stock that had been sold at the time the case was brought. However, when Mr. Dancy was questioned on the stand about the advertisement and the stock purchase, he could only recall a vague memory of the mail he had been sent and could not remember any specific details about the Black Star Line advertisement. In his closing arguments to the grand jury, Garvey pointed out that the government had not proved that he had made any statements about his shipping company that he had known were false. He and the other defendants had only the best intentions regarding the Black Star Line. And to that point, he added, "We had no monetary considerations or reward before us, but the good we could do for our own race. You will say it was bad business, but gentlemen, there is something spiritual beside business. I ask no mercy. I ask no sympathy. I ask but for justice." Now, after deliberating for 6 hours, the jury ultimately found Garvey guilty of fraud, and the other three defendants were acquitted of all charges against them. And on June 21st, 1923, Marcus Garvey was convicted, ordered to pay a fine of $1,000, and sentenced to a 5-year prison term. Okay? So Garvey was most certainly not without his own set of controversies in his life, and as previously mentioned, the management of the Black Star Line really left a lot to be desired, and, you know, notwithstanding obviously the later fraud allegations, but more off the fact that most of the fleet that was purchased was really purchased for prices that were greatly inflated over their value, and the condition of the ships was not up to par in terms of seaworthiness. Now, you know, the pricing of the ships could entirely be because, obviously, again, at that time, there were no Black-owned shipping fleets, and, you know, in order to get the best price that they could possibly get, you know, from willing sellers, Marcus Garvey and the UNIA may have had to buy less than seaworthy ships, and definitely for prices that were grossly inflated over their value. You know, and to be real with you, that's kind of the nature of the beast when it comes to having to deal with sellers that don't look like you and don't have your own best interest, or, you know, the best interest of your race at heart. And that's just unfortunate, but it's possibly a major part of the reason as to why. Now, you know, in addition to that, though, you know, on a personal note, you know, obviously Amy Ashwood Garvey was his first wife. Not the last wife, not the second wife, but the first. And when they divorced in 1922, after getting married in 1919, Marcus Garvey very quickly married a woman named Amy Jacques, who was actually Amy Ashwood's former roommate and maid of honor. And the two of them got married 1 month after his divorce from Amy Ashwood. You know, that in its own right is going to rub some people the wrong way. But on top of that as well, you know, as we mentioned, Garvey did something that his other contemporaries were not doing at the time, and that was actually availing himself to an international scale and trying to affect the whole of the African diaspora. This actually led to many disagreements and run-ins and verbal spats with other, quote, Black leaders of the time, and even kind of a running feud with an NAACP. Now, as Garvey expressed his concerns with Blacks living in countries where they were a minority, he believed that continual demands for equality by American Blacks would threaten whites and lead to increasingly violent racial conflicts. He believed that a strong African nation, however, might be able to force other countries to respect the rights of their Black citizenry, thus the Back to Africa movement. Now, Garvey's critics charged that his ideas were really hopelessly unrealistic, and that the dreams of Garvey followers, which overwhelmingly were the impoverished working class, amounted to nothing more than pipe dreams. They said that Black Americans should instead forget about moving to Africa, where they were total strangers, and should instead concentrate their efforts on improving their conditions within the United States. Obviously, Garvey disagreed with this to a large degree. Garvey had actually been increasingly hostile to lighter-skinned black leaders as well, believing that they looked down upon their darker brothers and sisters. Now, Garvey had a very, very strong mistrust of whites and completely excluded them in membership with the UNIA, and he really addressed this hostility towards W.E.B. Du Bois and the NAACP due to the fact that the NAACP membership was actually open to both blacks and whites, which Garvey considered to be a dangerous mistake. Because as he insisted, in his own words, though there may be a few good white men in America, there is no white man honest enough, sympathetic enough, humane enough, liberal enough to really take up the Negro's cause and fight it to a successful conclusion. Now, Garvey and the UNIA advocated and adopted a principle of racial separatism, really believing wholeheartedly that whites and blacks must establish their own separate social and political institutions, their own churches, their own schools, their own businesses, even to the point of saying their own governments. Now, the NAACP, Garvey actually charged, wanted to destroy the black race through intermarriage with whites. Garvey claimed that Du Bois and his kind, in his words, believe that the black race will become, through social contact and intercourse, so mixed up with the white race as to produce a new type, probably like Du Bois himself, which will in time become the real American. Now, I'm sure you can understand just from that quote alone why it is that W.E.B. Du Bois and Garvey would not get along. That is some very racially charged language, and there is nothing, you know, that I've ever seen, at least, to suggest that Du Bois held that view or that the NAACP espoused that view. However, that is what Garvey believed, and that is what he said. Now, it goes even further than this, right? And it really creates even more separatism in this next act. So, in early 1922, Garvey made what amounted to be a very, very, very grave mistake. Hoping to win the support of the Ku Klux Klan for his Back to Africa movement, yes, you heard me correctly, hoping to win the support of the Ku Klux Klan for his Back to Africa movement, Marcus Garvey met with the then Klan leader, Edward Young Clark. Now, Clark wished to learn about Garvey's views on racial purity and his plans for the black race. While Garvey never actually supported the Klan's positioning, and especially not their campaigns of violence and terror against blacks, he did believe that the organized hostility of white supremacist groups was useful because it forced blacks to unite. Now, he may have a point there, but the meeting obviously just carries negative undertones. In the end, however, he believed that the ultimate tie that bound the two groups together was the belief that blacks and whites could not and should not live together. Due to this, the majority of black leaders vehemently disagreed with Garvey and that positioning. In mass, they joined together to denounce Garvey's meeting with the Klan and ultimately branded him as the worst kind of race traitor. In fact, W.E.B. Du Bois would go on to write, "Marcus Garvey is, without doubt, the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race in America and in the world. He is either a lunatic or a traitor." There was another actually noted black educator, William Pickens, who once told Garvey, "You compare the aims of the Ku Klux Klan in America with your aim in Africa. And if that be true, no civilized man can endorse either of you." Now, what really shocked and appalled Garvey critics the most was his complete willingness to abandon the fight for black rights in America. But as we mentioned, I can't say that that view was not necessarily coming from a good place. As we mentioned before, Garvey did not necessarily believe that there should be an abandonment of that struggle, but instead thought that if there was a very strong, united African nation to support these aims in other countries, it would be much more effective. I don't know if I agree or disagree with that. I can understand the premise and the submission of that, but I don't know if I wholeheartedly agree. Maybe the unity of Africans in Europe and the unity of Africans in Central America and the unity of Africans in the United States is what would lend the most rather than having a strong nation overseas. Now, after his conviction in 1923, Garvey's sentence of 5 years was eventually commuted by then-President Calvin Coolidge. However, upon his release in November of 1927, he was then deported to Jamaica. In 1929, September to be exact, he founded the People's Political Party with a focus on workers' rights, education, and aid to the poor. This would actually serve to be Jamaica's first modern political party. In April of 1931, he launched the Edelweiss Amusement Company, what essentially amounted to a company that was structured and focused on the promotion of artists and helping them to earn a livelihood through their crafts and their talents. Okay. So in 1935, Garvey actually left Jamaica for London. Until his death in 1940, he lived and worked in London, but he remained in touch with events in Ethiopia and in the West Indies. If you recall back to our Haile Selassie episode, you can probably understand why he stayed in touch with the events of Ethiopia. And obviously his homeland was the West Indies. In 1938, he established a school of African philosophy in Toronto with the aim of training future UNIA leaders. Now, Marcus Garvey unfortunately passed away on June 10th, 1940 in London at the age of 52. After reading a mistakenly printed obituary about himself in the newspaper The Chicago Defender, which was printed in January of the same year, which stated in part that Garvey had died broke, alone, and unpopular, he suffered from two major strokes. 20 years after his death, Garvey's body was removed from London and taken to Jamaica, where the government proclaimed him Jamaica's first national hero and actually had his remains reinterred at the National Heroes Park. Now, in the years since his untimely death, there's been numerous schools, colleges, highways, and buildings across Africa, Europe, the Caribbean, and the United States that have been named in his honor. The flag of the UNIA, the distinctive red, black, and green, has been adopted as the Black Liberation Flag. And since 1980, Garvey's bust has been housed in the Organization of America's States Hall of Heroes in Washington, D.C. The parents of Elhaj Malik Shabazz, also more popularly known as Malcolm X, actually met at a UNIA convention in Montreal, Quebec. And Malcolm X's father was actually president of the UNIA division in Omaha, Nebraska. The national shipping line of Ghana is named the Black Star Line in honor of Marcus Garvey and the UNIA, as well as the Ghanaian national flag sporting a black star in its center, paying homage to the Black Star Line. In a trip to Jamaica in June of 1965, Martin Luther King Jr. told an audience that Marcus Garvey was the first man of color to lead and develop a mass movement. He was the first man on a scale and level to give millions of Negroes a sense of dignity and destiny and make the Negro feel he was somebody. Now, in closing, I really hope that you enjoyed this episode of our podcast series. As I mentioned prior to, this should have been the first episode of our series, but we did have some technical issues, and I'm sure if you listened to it, you could hear what those were. So I do apologize for those. We will attempt to make every best effort to keep our issues to a minimal. And if there are other issues, obviously, we'll do the same as we did for this one and provide an updated episode. So I hope that you really enjoyed learning about Marcus Garvey and the Pan-African movement, both the good, the bad, and the ugly. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, please feel free to send us an email at info@thisiscarrington.com. Feel free as well to visit our website at blackhistorypodcast.com to catch an episode of this, as well as books, resources, other links to things that will help you in your journey to self-enlightenment. We also will have a complete archive of all of our past episodes listed on there, and also a listing of all of our future episodes to come. Well, not all, but a good piece of them. We'll make every best effort in future episodes to address any comments and or questions that you may have. In addition, if you find any errors, please let us know. Because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Thank you again, and we hope you look forward to next week's episode.